into the second prayer of the Amidah, right? Toch kedei, meaning within the discussion that the Gemara had about inserting the line Mashiva Ruach Morid Hagashem, the Gemara also mentioned and seemed to bundle the insertion Tein Tal Umatar Livracha, the request for rain that's going to happen at a later time within one's personal Amidah in the weekday prayers. And it's notable that at this point in ritual history, that probably both of those were really a bundle. They might have started saying, the God who is the power, who causes the rain to fall and the wind to blow, we recognize you. And now, since we're recognizing that the rainy season is here, we're also requesting it down the line in the prayers. That it was a bundle in terms of the time it started as well. Today we have different dates for those starting points. We already said, and we've understood, that though there was a halachic argument about when we start, we've determined that Shmini Atzeret is the day that we start saying Mashiv HaRuach HaMorid HaGashem, and that the request for rain is still on the table, though, at this point. When do we start saying that? When do we make the request? I'll just point out that the Gemara gave us a sense that we were exploring theologically what powers God really has and can really still capture our theological imaginations or theological inclinations. Even with the ancients, they had to pick out ones that really were, for them, divine. Meaning, those that were separate even from aspects of the world that were still considered to be parts of God's creation, but were more understandable in some ways, more predictable in some ways, like the seasons, like rain, how precipitation might work. Though they had ancient understandings of those items or measures of reality, they had understandings nonetheless. But the power of life, the power of death, the power of the rains at their right moments and the way that it interacted with the production, the yield in agriculture, all really faith versus hard science. To go back to Charlie's Habura. The other surprising, or not so surprising, because it was the rabbinic culture that we encounter in every couple of pages of Gemara, was that, remember, there's a moment where the prayer is really front and center, not the agriculturalist, not the farmer. And it's the one who prays that's highlighted throughout the whole discussion, really, in the backdrop, recognizing all these things. So prayer and being a prayer is very important. And because the rabbinic culture is front and center, it has primacy of place by way of the kind of cultures that are in dialogue with one another. We got a certain moment where the metaphors were couched in language of rain and language of growth and language of fire and dry and wet, all those, for the study of Torah, for the chachamim, for the sages. They introduced a section on page 4, first side, 4a, about how a young scholar is likened to a seed planted in a clod of earth, right? And Torah, like rain, comes and nurtures the mind, the soul, the spirit, and rabbinic culture is now brought to this very explicit place on page 4 already here. Though we're talking about the rains and how much we appreciate the rain and how much we need the rain and how much the produce depends on the rain in the right seasons and all the godly powers that deal with life, death, and rain itself and the judgments that are happening for life and death and rains. But that notion that I'm going to be grounded in this metaphor of agriculture, farming, rains, seasons, life, death, that the rabbis are interested in making sure we understand, already on page 4, we're also talking about the life of Torah, the life of Torah learning, the life of the reins of God, meaning words of Torah, nurturing your mind, nurturing your soul, allowing for you to become the fertile field, allowing for you to experience the growth, or allowing for the harvesting of the ideas and those that come, and allowing for the recognition that emotional life can be tamed through, or even fires of anger can be flamed through the notion of the passion one has for Torah and what Torah learning is all about. And the culture of learning is, I've made the argument statement, it's given primacy of place in the middle, almost like a chiastic structure on a literary function. I'm thinking now in literary forms, because last night I attended a most wonderful, wonderful symposium and book launch for my dear friend, Dr. Eitan Fishbane, who wrote the first full exploration of the Zohar as literature and through the eyes of literary criticism. And he talked about the scaffolding of the literary structures that were well known to readers in the Castile environment of Christendom, let alone Jewish readers, and how the text itself is dramatic and plays out like a painting's images would. If, you know, in Christendom the paintings were the glory of their time, and Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus was shown with three fingers in the air, this meant that he was ready to speak. But for Jews, who had no art making on their agenda, per se, during that time, in the grand scheme of painting and painterliness that had developed during that time, what they had was words and literary structures. And this is Eitan's now claim, that the Zohar makes use of so much of that. And this is as much a foray into the structures of aesthetics that are coming out of the Middle Ages into the, you know, out of Spain and out of that corridor, Castile particularly, and the geography, how it plays in, and the landscapes and the dramas of that time and how they play out. Well, come back to the Gemara. There's an argument to be made that the literary structure of the Gemara, also we have to take into account what's at the beginning, what ends the conversation before the next Mishnah, and what's in the middle. And almost in the middle here is this discussion of rabbinic culture. So to make the chiastic structure come to that center point. And rabbinic culture and the culture of Torah learning and the fertile nature of the soul and the development of religiosity and life and the tempering of passion or directing of passion, like the storms and the rains. You can hear the thunder rumbling as the metaphorical ways of describing the understanding of all of the textuality that they're bringing forth, and letting that be like beautiful rainstorms, all this midrash. Now we're mixing this rainy reality and the power of God to create that rain, and the power of God to give wisdom to Chachamim, who are creating the rains of Torah, the storms and the winds of this culture blowing in. Because the rabbis have an idea to establish their culture. And while they're establishing the culture ritually, they're establishing the whole nature of the culture in a certain reality. And that's going to play back, that theme or that literary approach, structurally and also content-wise, is going to play out in this Masechta, because it's not only about fasts for rains. You know, though we're going to talk a little bit more about rains, and you could be saying to yourself, are we still really in the request for rain? Yes, we are for the fact that it creates some structure for us, because we're talking about that attention to the natural world we have that we bring into our prayer experience. But we're also going to now start to mention other kinds of rabbinic concepts. And we're going to talk through some rabbinic history and stories about sages that, yes, started with those sages opining about prayer and when we start to say lines concerning the natural phenomena. But we're going to get into a little bit more about rabbinic culture, and then we're going to talk about Jewish history. So onward we go into this halachic inquiry first, which is going to bring us to a certain number of, again, rabbinic culture and establishing and asserting and rooting rabbinic culture in all that was and all that will be. Now, one note before we start that Mishnah, one more note before we start that Mishnah. I mentioned to you that I purchased this incredible study of Masechet Tanit by Tal Ilan, which is a fantastic scholarly inquiry to our tractate. And it's worth our noting what Ilan notes, and that is, there's only one place in the whole Babylonian Talmud, before we leave all those Gemaras behind from the first Mishnah, there's only one place in the whole Babylonian Talmud that deals with the story of Yiftach. Yiftach was, remember, the military man during the time of the Judges who is hired by Israel, who's convinced that he should go lead the troop, and he asks God for help, but he does so by making a vow, right? And he says, I will sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my door if you deliver us in victory. And to point out again, the Bavli, the Talmud Bavli, is hypercritical of Yiftach, saying that he actually asked inappropriately. He made an inappropriate vow. And since it's the only place in the Bavli that deals with it, we can't pass up the chance to just assert, again, the kind of criticism that the rabbis are making of Yiftach's vow to God. And therefore, we get the key to the power that exists, not the power of God that exists, but we get the key, to use the Midrashic theme that we saw on page 2 already, we get the key to the power of dialing back vows in this Gemara. Because words are so important by us that we say, Bli Neder. When we say, I make a commitment to you to bring this to you tomorrow, Bli Neder. I'm not making a vow. This is what we say. If you're in traditional circles, you might hear it. Just like you hear Baruch Hashem. How are you? Baruch Hashem. How are you? Thank God. Right? The other thing you could hear consistently is, if I promise you something, Bli Neder. I'm not making a vow. But here, Yiftach is not only criticized for vowing to sacrifice the first thing that walks through his door, but we understand that the power of reversing vows, though they're so powerful, is actually in our hands. Just like God granted certain of those real, real godly powers to certain individuals for a certain amount of time, but not permanently, we read. Like the power of life, when it came to the revival of certain, you know, we thought it was ancient CPR, right? Prophets, when they did that. So I want to point that out because inside the text really wove a picture of Yiftach the Giladite as it's written, and it shall be that whatever emerges from the doors of my house, Asher Yese Midilati Veiti, that he says that, I'm actually just going back to 4a for a minute, and then we'll flip back to 5 where I said we're going to start. Yachol Afilu Davar Tame, it says on the bottom of the right-hand column, now it's possible that Yiftach meant to offer even something unclean, like a pig or a dog, Hey Shivo Shalo Kahogan, and Yiftach responded, God responded to Yiftach in an improper manner, meaning God really taught him a lesson. When he swore that he was going to sacrifice something inappropriate, God taught him a lesson and he sent his daughter out of the house. Now you could say up to there, from the Tanakh, I'm on 4a1 on the right-hand side, if you're following the text. You could say, how could God do such a thing? God sent his daughter. Behainu dekamar lehu navi, and now I'm on 4a2 on the left-hand column, Yisrael. In reference to this, the prophet said to Israel, is there no balm in Gilad? Im rofe ein sham. Is there no physician there? And we said again, and I want to point this out just so that we don't leave here again. We don't leave here without knowing that the Talmud Bavli opined about Yiftach, that this is absolutely not what God wants. That it was really his mistake to promise such a thing. That the whole episode with the daughter is just not befitting any Jew and any Jewish community to allow this to happen. Because what that means is didn't you go and find Pinchas, who was the prophet at that time? Didn't you go and find him and have him annul your vow? Didn't you do the ceremony of annulling vows? I know vows are important, but didn't you go and find him? And what they're playing off here, and which I wanted to point out to you is that the Bavli affirms earlier Tanaitic texts that they're basically weaving together, which we get in a study such as this from Tali Lan. What the Bavli does is it asks, was there no physician there? In other words, that's the code for, was there no smart thinking? Was there? Why didn't you go and get this fixed? And the Gemara cites after that on 482, Uchtiv asher lo tziviti velo dibarti velo alta alibi. And it's written, God says in three different languages, I didn't command this, I didn't speak of this, and I didn't even come up to, it didn't even come up in my mind to ask for children's sacrifice, child sacrifice. And three verbs prove three different times that children were to be sacrificed. No, I didn't ask for it. Not with Isaac, not with this king, Mesha of Moab, to even an other god, I'm not asking for it. And not by you, Yiftach. And yes, the text says she dies alone later. And I told you that the tradition is that she dies not married and childless, so therefore her whole line is gone. But inside the Gemara, this small passage, which is the single place that the Bavli deals with Yiftach, who swore to sacrifice his daughter, that it says, no way, no how. You could have annulled the vow, and I never said it, not tziviti, not amarti, not dibarti, not alta alibi. Didn't come up, even as a thought in my mind, God says. And that is a weave of three different texts. A text from Midrash Rabbah, a text from Sifri, and a text from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It's a summary of those three texts woven together. Almost like in the history of Jewish literature, I think I've mentioned this before, if you look up there, there are three volumes on the top shelf, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, if you're interested. It's called Sefer Haggadah, the Book of Legends. Okay, it's a Chaim Nachum Bialik project. When Israel is becoming a state, he's worried that all of our literature will be lost, and there's a Hebrew version in the middle of two magnificent, masterful translations of it, Book of Legends, Sefer Haggadah in Hebrew, and in a journal that David Roski started at the seminary called Proof Texts. He describes the history of Jewish literature and its development, and one of those literary pieces that is described is Sefer Haggadah, it's the Book of Legends. There's an article about that book by my teacher, Dr. Mark Bregman. Mark showed how Bialik took ancient Midrashim from Tanaitic era through the Middle Ages and weaves tales that has all the elements. And underneath are footnotes. And you can see from which Midrash different parts of the story come about any given character of the Bible in the first section or about topics in Judaism in the back. It's different than Ginsberg, Legends of the Jews. Why am I giving you that as the early 20th century project that we have to think about? Because the Gemara here in the Bavli, you know, this is what we get excited about when we see texts and how they work, right? These are three texts from the Tanaitic era that the Bavli affirms by weaving them together in a shorter and more exquisite package to tell us no way, no how for Yiftach and what he promised. And the part that is in Bereshit Rabbah, the Midrash on Bereshit, is that he didn't ask appropriately. The part that's in Sifri is this little Midrash about the three words. And the part that's in Shir HaShirim Rabbah is really about negating the fact that a daughter should be sacrificed at all. And then there's a continuation in Midrash Bereshit Rabbah that has the theme of this whole question about was there no prophet in Israel, no doctor to take care of this, no vow breaker that you searched out? And it's even worse, and if you knew these texts as a reader or a listener, you really, really felt that the criticism is here. Because what does that text say? It says, they both stood on ceremony. Yiftach says that Pinchas should have come to me. I'm the valiant soldier here, the hero of all Israel. And Pinchas said, I'm the priest. That battle ready for hire mercenary, let him come my way. And the two of them never make it to one another. And they stand on kavod. They stand on their honor. And that one should come to the other. So standing on such ceremony leads to what? The murder of his daughter. The murder. Because God didn't command it, didn't say it. What's that?
So she should suffer?
Right. So that's the question that you're left with. And the reason why I'm also bringing this book is because they're willing to ask that question. This is from the master project of feminist commentaries on the Babylonian Talmud, of which my teacher, Dr. Arya Cohen, is part of, and Dr. Sharon von Robert is part of, and many, many around the Jewish world are asked to take a look and be part of each individual tractate, right? And so... Yes. Charlotte is a woman, for instance. Arya is not. But I don't know if, actually, Tal... I don't know Tal personally, but Tal is sometimes a man's name, sometimes a woman's name, so I'm not sure this volume, if it's a man or a woman. But I just want you... I want you to hear what's written in here about it. The story of Yiftach's daughter is one of the most tragic in the Bible. Her father vows to God to sacrifice to him whoever comes out of the door of his house after his victory, and it turns out to be his daughter. He is completely defeated by this development, but goes on and sacrifices her all the same. So if you really want to read it, that he did it, here it is, plainly. The story is easily comparable with the famous episode about the near sacrifice of Isaac in the book of Genesis, yet the outcome of the two, completely different. While God intervenes at the last moment to save Isaac, nothing comparable happens to Yiftach's daughter. And she died. Gender-sensitive scholars note the gender difference between the two children about to be sacrificed by their fathers. The male is saved, but the female is sacrificed. The story has raised difficult questions for the rabbinic interpreters. Genesis Rabbah contains the first full discussion of Yiftach's daughter by the rabbis. The discussion is triggered by a verse about the choice of Rebekah as a bride for Isaac by Abraham's servant, and his request is compared to Yiftach's vow. That's our passage. Right? That's just the Bavli bringing to light also what's in Genesis Rabbah. We observe here, in the case of Yiftach's vow, sacrilege might have occurred. And in our case, I'm asserting, it did occur, according to the Midrash. Yiftach may have offered God an unclean animal as sacrifice. To this, God reacted mercilessly by sending out Yiftach's daughter. Yet, we may also observe here another disparity between the three cases, which are answered favorably, and this one, which is answered negatively. In all the three other cases, we find biblical male heroes about to be married: Isaac, Othniel, the first judge, and David. God seems disinclined to punish his male heroes, and so the vows, and they or someone on their behalf made, brought about the right match. The case of Yiftach's daughter is dissimilar. No one is about to get married here. In fact, we hear at the end of the story that the daughter dies tragically as an unmarried virgin. As opposed to his male heroes, on whom God takes pity, he has no such compassion for his female ones. Now, that's to point out. No such compassion really was shot of the Tanakh. Until you then reassert that Tanakh can't exist without the oral Torah. And that they complement, not only complement, but coexist even. And that all of the Tanakh is referential to the lessons sometimes that need to be explored within rabbinic literature. And what comes, and I won't read you the entire passage, what comes to light for me, this is very straightforward and tells it like it is, if you will, vis-a-vis the Pshat, is that if you believe that the canonization of Tanakh that is coexistent with the formulation of the project of the Mishnah and the project of the Gemara. And I use the word project instead of the, because there are lots of manuscripts for a long time until we get to, you know, the Talmud. Right? So you have Talmud that emerges. But remember that Mishnah and Talmud are emerging as canon is created in the realm of the Tanakh as well. And so they really do coexist. Even if you say that Judges is an early text. Or it could be a little later. But you have textuality on the whole. And the interplay of texts is a way of studying Torah, a la the rabbinic culture that's already introduced on page 4. And if I so strongly assert that I need rabbinic culture to really understand what the messages of Tanakh are really about, right? The messages of our Bible, in addition to laying out plans for a culture that's going to develop, I now have in my hands a story that is an exemplary story for the fact that I might have the attitude as a father that my daughter is less than. But let's be reassured. There's a way to undo a vow, and if the vow wasn't about sacrificing her on the altar, might it have been about marrying her to someone she didn't want to? I have a way of going and annulling that vow. There are people to go to when there is potential pain to be inflicted, worse yet murder. And God neither Siva commanded, Diber said it, nor Allah al-Dato, or had it in mind at all. So I've really done my work as the rabbis to quite opposite from the plain meaning of the text, which says, sacrifice her and not the guys. I've now upended that and said, and asserted through the Gemara and Tani, which I have to read if I'm a interested rabbinic player, because I got to know when to say this in my prayers, and I got to thank God for the rain because the harvest is coming. I also have to know what the Torah says and the Tanakh says about the place of daughters in our community. So I believe that these two coexist to really assert the woman's right, the daughter's right, and the mistaken piety of Yiftach. I think it's pretty cool. Okay, let's go to the other Mishnah. Second Mishnah in Tani. Page 5A1. Okay, here we go. So we're at the second Mishnah, and even though they were bundled and we've already heard about requesting rain, now we're going to have a separate Mishnah about rain. Ad matai sho'alin et ha-geshamim. Until when do we request rain? Now we want to know the end point for the request. Rabbi Yehuda omer ad shi'yavor ha-Pesach. Rabbi Yehuda says until Pesach is over. Right? All that sounds to me like all the way through Pesach, right? Pesach is over, meaning all this. Rabbi Meir omer ad shi'yetzei Nisan. Rabbi Meir says until the month of Nisan is ended. So Pesach is 8 days. Nisan is just a little longer, right? Because he has a pasuk, Shneamar, he has a verse. V'yored lechem geshem morerei malkosh berishon. Because it said he made rain fall for you, yorei and malkosh, in the first month in Nisan. Why is Nisan called the first month? Because according to what? Torah, Nisan is the first month. Gemara is going to ask about this verse that was brought. Now, morei and malkosh are words for the first rains, and malkosh is the last rain of the season. So those are important precipitation words in our tradition. We've mentioned that there's lots of precipitation words in the tradition, so those are two. So I told you the story that Rabbi Wexler, who will be in town soon, was in Yerushalayim. Did I tell you this story? Maybe I didn't tell the story. I did it on a Friday night. You're right, Dale. So here's a quick story. Morei, or Yorei. So Rabbi Wexler, I'm in touch with him just as the rainy season is starting, and it's a little past Cheshvan when, you know, in Eretz Yisrael they were starting to say, because we've already established that. And the wind's blowing. And the first rain's coming. It's called the Yorei, and not only the Morei. The root, even with Morei, is Yud Resh He. So the Yorei's coming. So Rabbi Wexler says, it was out of nowhere. I was stopping and I was going and I was picking up a few things for Shabbat, and who had a hat and who had a coat? All of a sudden the skies darken and I'm running to find cover over here, and I'm tucking myself in, and running from across the way, I see this guy, and, you know, if it was in New York, I would worry, who is this guy running at me like this? But we're in Yerushalayim, so you have a little bit of a different street sense. Like, here comes, okay, so you see the guy coming, and you don't really, and he's definitely looking secular as can be. You know, in Jerusalem, it's sometimes very easy. You know, you have a suit on, you have a yarmulke on your head, you look religious. You have ripped jeans and a t-shirt, and, you know, you come, and so he runs over, and he crouches in the same space as me, and he turns to me, and he says, Kavod HaRav, respect to the rabbi. He didn't really. Oh. He's just saying that because everybody called. Everybody, yeah, he looked religious. Okay. And anybody, you could either call him a robber, or you'd say, "Hey, tzaddik." That's the other way you could address somebody like that. But he says, "He's like dude." Says, "Hey, dude, what's the bracha for the yorek?" And Rabbi Wexler says, "What a question from this guy who's just run across the front of the state to escape." Just like I did the first rains of the season in Yerushalayim, and I think to myself, and I say to him, let's make this bracha about God's powers in the world, and they together, and he says, you know, Kavod HaRav again, dude, please cover my head, and the Rabbi Wexler holds his hand over the guy's head, and they make a blessing about God's powers in the world. Ose Maase Bereishis, who makes creation so beautiful. And he says, that is a Jerusalem story about the first rains. What a story it was. And it was a beautiful story. And Malkosh, that's when you know things are ending up. Malkosh is the last rain of the year. So Rav Nachman says to Rav Yitzchak, I'm now on the left-hand side, 5A1, Amar le Rav Nachman le Rav Yitzchak. Rav Nachman said to Rabbi Yitzchak, Yorei v'nisan, does the Yorei fall in Nisan? Yorei v'mar cheshvani. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that the first rain comes in Nisan? The first rain comes in Mar cheshvan. That's after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That's at Sukkot time. We just had this whole discussion. Ah, Ditnan or Ditanya, we have a brighter Yod, Eben Mar Cheshvan Umalkosh Benisan. We even have a rabbinic text that asserts that understanding. It's a brighter, meaning it's the time of the Mishnah, and we have another text that we're going to bring in. And that is that, as it was taught in a brighter, the Yorei rain falls in Mar Cheshvan, and the Malkosh rain in Nisan. So, what do you mean, again, by the first rains are in Nisan? So the Gemara explains the verse. Amar Lei, Rabbi Yitzchak answers Rabbi Nachman. Hachi Amar Rabbi Yochanan. This is what Rabbi Yochanan said. And by the way, we're going to get into a cycle here. Rabbi Nachman says to Yitzchak, and then they're going to learn from Rabbi Yochanan. And it's an important kind of learning going on that Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar are going to come into play. And just keep in mind that Rabbi Yochanan is an Eretz Yisraeli rabbi. He's an Israeli rabbi. And Rabbi Elazar is a Babylonian rabbi. And Rabbi Yochanan comes to Babel and also does some teaching there. And a lot of times, Rabbi Elazar learns a lot from Rabbi Yochanan. Just keep that in the back of our minds as we see the interactions of the rabbis here. They're of the same generation. Amar Lei, so Rabbi Yitzchak answers Rabbi Nachman. Rabbi Yochanan, thus says Rabbi Yochanan, Bimei Yoel ben Pituel nikayem mikraze. No, this verse that talked about the first rain and the last rain, where that verse describes a situation that happened at the time of the prophet Joel. That was unique to the time of the prophet Joel, the author of the biblical book of Joel. So, it's a verse that doesn't set out all our wisdom about the first rains and the last rains. It's describing an instance when, in fact, the first rain and the last rain was in Nisan. So what's the situation? If they don't have rain from Mar Cheshvan to Nisan?
It's a drought.
It's a drought. It's a unique year of a drought, or one of several years of a drought. They're very worried about droughts in the ancient world.
So you're saying that both the first and the last are in Nisan?
No, in this case, in the days of Yoel, in the days of the prophet Joel.
So they only had 1 month of rain.
Yeah, exactly. And here's that story. It's a story that's now going to be told. What happened that year? Dichtivei, concerning that which is written, Yeter hagazam achal arbe, that which the gazam locust has left, the arbe locust has eaten up. There was a seven-year famine, including a four-year locust plague. One type of locust came, and the next locusts came and ate up anything that the first locust didn't like to dine on. I mean, it was quite a time. It was quite a time. In the Steinsaltz edition...
Don't read it? He doesn't refer to it with the same English term.
Oh, yeah?
Gaza. He calls it the Palmer worm.
Oh, no.
Oh, the
Palmer worm.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no. Right here. Oh, my goodness. In my version, it says later they will have relatives and offspring that... No.
What?
It comes to tell.
That's it. So... This is a desert locust, according, can you see that far? They give you little full-color pictures in this version of the new Steinsaltz if you get the larger size. Black and white pictures if you get the smaller size of this Talmud. But now and then they have the realia. And you know that some locusts, they jump in. Some locusts, they fly in. And some locusts burrow in the ground and then rise. So... You could have a situation where all that, just conveniently by way of the ancient mindset of, you know, we're being plagued, happens 1, 2, 3, like that. Anyway, that was the situation. And what's that?
Are there seasons of the locusts?
Well, there are years of the locusts and seasons by way of different areas of the world have different times when in different kinds of insects affect their crop.
So... locusts before the Exodus.
Right. Could be that there was a season. Okay. So then, keep going down the left-hand side of the page. I'm at the bottom. So here's the miracle that happened. O Tashana Yatza Adar Velo Yardu Gishamim. That year, the month of Adar ended and still no rain. Still no rain. Now that's a crazy amount of time in Israel with no rain. Yardalahem Riviya Rishona Bechad Ben Nisan. Riviyas, the tip-tip-tipa kind of rain. The first rainfall came down for them. On the first of Nisan. Amarlahem Navili Israel, the prophet Yoel tells the people, Tzu'u, Uziru, get yourselves out to the fields and start planting. Go and sow the fields. Amrulo, they said to him, Mishiesh lo kav chitim o kavim sorin. If someone has a kav of wheat or two kavs of barley, these are good measures of barley, yochlenu v'yichyeh, let him eat them and live. You're asking for a miracle to happen for us to plant this within the season that's supposedly the rainy season. Just because the first rain came, you want us to take the seed and now plant it? No, I don't want to thresh this, right? Because what you have to do with your saved up stalks is you've got to get the seeds, right? And so you've got to bring that now to the threshing floor. And you've got to winnow it, and you've got to thresh it, and you've got to let them fall through, and you've got to take the seed.
So that means you can't eat it.
You can't eat it. Because all that's going to be left is basically hay. You're not going to have any of the berries. You're not going to have any of the wheat berries. You're not going to have any of the edible parts. Oh, Yizra Uva Yamut, sow it and die in hunger? We're going to have nothing to eat. In other words, we know even if we plant it, this takes a lot of time to grow. Amar Lehem, the prophet Yoel says to them, Af al pichein tzur ziru, nevertheless, you go and sow. Nas al hanes. There was a miracle. V'nigal alahem mashe b'katalin mashe b'chorei nemalim. They discovered grain in the walls and in antholes. In other words, they had some stuff stuffed around, right?
So is this the grain that they're going to plant, or is this the grain they're going to eat?
Well, listen, it's going to come. They went and they sowed the fields on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of Nisan with whatever grain they could find. Right? So that's the grain they're going to plant. They found it. V'yardalahem revi'a shniya v'chamisha v'nisan. And then the second rainfall came down for them on the 5th of Nisan. Hikrivu omer b'shisha asar b'nisan. And by the time the 16th of Nisan came, they had enough growth of barley to wave the omer offering. In days. Now, you could ask, how is that possible? So on the one hand, you could be a believer. On the other hand, you could say, there's a lot of planting in those fields. And there were seeds left from the beginning of time. It didn't dry out for some crazy reason. The drought didn't completely break everything and just let it wither away. That already there was some pre-growth.
Well, they would have planted that fall.
Exactly. So that the miracle here is the miracle of nature working itself. And even when there's drought, that the rain itself is so life-giving. The wetness comes to overcome the dryness. But it's all from the one God in heaven. And Nimtzei Tevua Hagadela B'Shishi Chodeshim. It transpires that grain, which normally takes 6 months to grow, Gadela B'Chadasar Yom, grew in 11 days, or I had sproutings in 11 days, and I could bring my barley over. Now, can you imagine this? Usually we have these beautiful, tall sheaves of barley. And in my visual mind, I'm saying, what did it look like that year? You know, they didn't need to bring the big, tall sheaves. So this year, everybody got lulavs this big. You know what I mean? For Sukkot. So this year, the Omer offering, you know, what was it? This tall? That tall? It wasn't here. You know, I could just see it. I could see the play of this midrash. I could see the visual treat of the midrash just showing you it's okay. God accepts whatever grew in those amount of days. Nimsa Omer Hakarev Mitvua Shel Shisha Chodeshim. It transpired that the Omer offering, which is usually brought from grain that grew over a 6 month period, Karev Mitvua Shel Chadasar Yom. It was brought from grain that was only 11 days old, or from the grain that grew. Ba'al oto ador hu omer, and in reference to that generation, it says, Hazorim bedima, those who planted with tears of sadness, berina yiktzoru, in great rejoicing will they reap. And that is in our what? Our Birkat HaMazon, when we have a yantiv and we don't have tachnun. Shir hamalo berina yitzoru halofelechu. We sing this as part of our appreciation for what it is that it nourishes us every time we say Birkat HaMazon with a shir hamalo. Gemara interprets the following verse in Psalms as referring to the same miracle. We won't get into the details there. It's just another way of saying that this miraculous story was the story of rain not in its season, coming and affirming life. By the way, in the backdrop, what was the Mishnah about? Now remember, this is Gemara on our Mishnah. What's our Mishnah saying?
When do we stop saying the request?
So it said, until when do we request? So we have been saying, we feel like nothing's happening, and why do we say it? Up to now? Because you need it sometimes. Because you need it sometimes. And you should realize that your request matters. Even if you thought nothing was coming, it matters that you did it all season long and you were good yidden and you said it, and even if you didn't get it, you got it in Nisan. And Yoel, who had the inspiration to say, Joel, no, go out there and plant it. Good things are coming. They relied on their hope. Because it didn't come in its season. You could have been despondent. But we needed his hope. Comment? Something else you see in the story?
Agricultural Hanukkah.
It's an agricultural Hanukkah. I like that. It really is. And it's how many days? Wait, was it 8 days? No, it was 11 days. 11 days. It wasn't the time of Pesach, but there's another great assignment if anybody ever asks you from now on. What's 11 mean to the Jewish tradition? So now you have another 11. The miracle of the Omer offering in the time of the prophet Joel. You know, we like to think we're very literate about our numbers, right? There you go. There's another 11. I love it. For Echad Miyodeh. Who knows 11? I know 11.
It sounds like a world that is suffering climate change.
It does, doesn't it? But oftentimes in the ancient world, there were these spells of drought. And we have those attestations in some of the records from Royal Assyria. And also from the Amarna letters in more ancient Egypt.
It's also part of the Joseph story.
Yes, and you could just, right now, here we are. Vayeshev, we're beginning the Joseph cycle. It's truly timely.
I wonder whether, because things are kind of mixed up and it was a very unusual span, whether the growth wasn't also very unusual. You see this now with a lot of climate change and things. You get this unusual pattern of stuff happening that didn't happen
before.
Well,
we used to have four seasons, now we have two.
Yeah, I mean, it can happen that something... I was thinking, though, that they know how long it took for that plant to grow. But there is this bean that little kids do, and they put it, you know, within a week, they've got a sprout of bean, and there are things mm-hmm. that can sprout in a week.
That is for sure. That is for sure the case.
Something like bamboo grows incredibly fast. They didn't have bamboo there.
No, but the point is that you're very much right, and I'm not sure, honestly, whether or not a good seed, a good barley seed, or a good wheat seed, grows that fast, which is why I'm thinking about what they had potentially put into the earth beforehand. But it could be very true that they, I mean, that it was this big,
yeah,
and that the visualization that I'm even giving for this meant no, but they really brought just that enough to wave whatever they could, you know. And I love that image that God still accepts just that little bit of growth as the owner.
They were probably doing selecting back then, though. I can't imagine they weren't. I mean, you know, they didn't do advanced genetic manipulation on the plants, but I'm sure they like picked, you know, plants with the sweeter fruit. They said, let's take these plants and propagate them.
So I wouldn't doubt for a minute that they knew. Selection. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt for a minute they knew which is the potentially better yielding seed.
You know, yes, I'm
and
sure they're
doing
that.
One easiest to get the
seeds
out of.
Right, to thresh.
To thresh.
Yeah, I would imagine.
They are not going to allow the seeds to blow away and keep them long enough to thresh.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine that they had a lot of lamaseg wisdom about these things. You know, in our experience, this is where we got the strongest. And let's save that for planting and let's eat this one. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so now we're going to move to 582 on the right side. And I'm going to go on the right side of 582. Where Rav Nachman poses another question that Rav Yitzchak answers with a teaching, again, from Rabbi Yochanan. Okay? So, in the new Stein salts, it's going to be Mai Dichtiv Bekirbacha. Second from the bottom?
Second paragraph.
Yeah, okay. 25-second paragraph from the bottom, those of you who have that. Okay. So here you go. Amar le Rav Nachman, the Rav Yitzchak. We have another one. Rav Nachman says the Rav Yitzchak. Mai dichtiv, what does it mean when Scripture writes? And this is coming from Hosea 11:9. Bakir b'cha kadosh v'lo avo b'ir. What is the meaning of that which is written? There is something holy in your midst, and I, God, meaning a God, will not enter the city. Okay, so there's something holy, clause 1, and I will not enter the city, clause 2. Mishum debekir b'cha kadosh, because there's something holy in your midst, in this case you see that the bracketed remark is, you perform good deeds, lo avo ba'ir. I will not enter the city? What does that mean? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Amar Lei, Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Nachman, Hachi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan taught, this is what it meant. Just like Rabbi Yochanan helped us figure out the last verse, which meant that there was a time when Joel was alive and the first and the last rain was in Nisan in a given year of plagues, right? Now Rabbi Yochanan is going to help us be the decipherer of the verse in question again. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu says, Lo avo b'Yerushalayim shel mala, I will not enter the celestial Jerusalem, ad she'avo l'Yerushalayim shel mata, until I enter the earthly Jerusalem. So until the Holy One is in your midst, meaning in the earthly Jerusalem, I'll not enter the city of Jerusalem. Now what could that mean? Just up to there. What could that mean? Until I am in Jerusalem down below, I'm not going to be on the Jerusalem up high. Meaning what? Until what?
It's rebuilt.
Until it's rebuilt, if we're talking about the period where it was destroyed. Until? Beit HaMikdash. Until?
People are behaving properly, whether it's fulfilling mitzvot or being behaving properly.
So the presence of God in Yerushalayim because of the actions of the people, right? Because we have a Gemara that says because of Sinat Chinam, because people were acting so cruelly towards each other, hateful with no basis, God left. Until there's good behavior, menschlichkeit, until there's people who follow God's ways, Torah, mitzvot, until there's the temple down below, I won't come into the Jerusalem on high. Gemara asks, Umi ika Yerushalayim l'mala? Is there really a Jerusalem on high? Like, what are you talking about? I get Jerusalem down below, right? But tell me about it, or let's say it more innocently. Tell me about this concept of Jerusalem on high. Yeah, that is a rabbinic understanding of the city of Yerushalayim. In other words, we have this approach to understanding Jerusalem in reality. And that is, there's a Yerushalayim shel mata and a Yerushalayim shel mala, a lower and an upper. Dichtiv, Yerushalayim habenuya ke'ir shechubra layachtav. And there is a built-up Jerusalem that will be like a city which is joined together with it, so that it's a unified Jerusalem, as opposed to a dual Jerusalem, and that it will be connected, one down below and the one on high, so that we are sure not to, and this is the point, not to suggest that there's a dualism, a fighting between a Jerusalem of good and a Jerusalem of evil, but chuvra yachta, that it comes together. And that there's a heavenly and earthly Jerusalem is a concept that the Bavli is now asserting and wants to plant in our fiber as rabbinic Jews, good rabbinic Jews. And we should be familiar with this because there's other texts that already introduced the concept that was, for its time, if you were a literate Jew, familiar, if you will, or you heard this potentially, most likely, from quote-unquote other literature that's around. And I want to share with you some of that other literature so that I think what's going on here in the Bavli again, organized, edited, put to bed, 7th, 8th century CE, right? But they're going to include that which they really want to make canonical, in a sense. And they're including text that potentially some of you know, if this is the earliest strata of it, very early text that is around, again, Tanaitic times, Brita times, maybe even before. Okay? So we're going to look at one of those texts together. But there were some comments and questions before I pass around the text. Was there a comment or a question? Ron, did you have something?
I have one. Have you seen any images of the two Jerusalems in a connection?
Yeah, there's some wonderful images. Everything from folky looking Jewish art to some more
dark
painters in the spot.
Recent?
Recent. Not so much by way of our painters, like Polish school of Jewish painters, Chagall. Chagall has one that definitely is the best, more modern, right? So the Gottlieb doesn't really do so much with that idea, except to say that some people suggest there's a painting of one of his paintings in a shtetl, when he came back to the shtetl after being in Vienna for art school, and he has this idea that there's a shelmala in the reality of this, even the sad and longing faces of the shtetl, because Gottlieb does these portraits,
yeah,
that there's a longing for the shelmala in his paintings of the ascension of the higher spiritual Jerusalem and Jewish spirituality somehow up into those portraits that he makes. So I forget who talks about it that way, but there's one critic or historian who talks a little bit about that with him. Okay, so let's take a look at this. I'll show you the book it comes from. This is a really cool book, a beautiful book. Daniel Sperber is a neighbor of Rabbi Wexler in the Old City. Daniel Sperber is scholar beyond scholars, just volumes of the histories of customs of Israel, and just fantastic 8-volume set of the mistums and customs, the minhagim, customs of Israel. And he put together this book on the Midrashim that mentioned Yerushalayim. One summer, if you recall, we at least studied some of these together from the book. That's why there are tags here. There's a little summer learning project. We did not do this one. So if you remember each and every one that we studied and you were in that class, you didn't get to this one, don't worry. This is an add-on. And it's a beautiful book, and what it is that he has these wonderful retellings of lots of tales of Jerusalem that link to verses, and he had a beautiful calligrapher do some work in the book, just with some wording to make it wonderfully inviting to read in big print. But these are real Midrashim, even though it's so big. And what he did is he then put in the back the different Midrashim. He listed them out, and he put the Midrash, he laid it out nice and wonderfully large, like the size of a Talmud almost, right? That's somewhat of the idea. And he has the Midrash, and then he has pages and pages of commentary on each of the Midrash. Each of the Midrashim that mention Jerusalem in some way, shape, or form. Some of the other ones we studied during the summer were Adam and Eve were the first to sacrifice on the spot in Jerusalem that would become the place where the Akedah happened, so that we have this link to all of humanity. Jerusalem is the navel of the world, if there's a belly button for the world. So that was one of the Midrashim. We talked about it being the center. We talked about Yerushalayim being this place of great potential peace, in addition to working out strife, which just kind of mentioned in how you thought about the city, upper and lower. So take one of these and we'll learn about the heavenly and the earthly Jerusalem. Mercy. Oh. Send those around, will you? So this will kind of answer, like, so what was being referred to in the Babli in a shorter sense? So we'll hear it as we read through it. Okay? So this is building off the verse in Exodus, Ele Pikudei HaMishkan. These are the sum totals and the accountings of the tabernacle. Ze she'amar hakatuv, concerning this, the verse said, Kise chavod marom merishon mekom mikdash shenu. A high throne of glory from the beginning is the place of our sanctuary. So a high throne is the place of our sanctuary, meaning what? That Yerushalayim Shalmala, the supernal and upper Jerusalem, is kind of like a model for the altar down below, or the sanctuary down below. Sham mechuvan mikdashenu. To there is our sanctuary directed. So our sanctuary is directed to that upper place. V'chein hu omer, and it's also said, Machon l'shivtecha pa'alta Adonai, mikdash Adonai konenu yadecha. Lord, thou hast made a site for thy dwelling in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. V'chein atamotzei, and thusly you find, Yerushalayim mechuvenet l'mala. Jerusalem is directed to that Jerusalem on high is also equal and oppositely directed, what? Mechuvenet l'mala kamo sheYerushalayim shelmata, to the face of the Jerusalem that's below. Merov ahavata shelmata, and out of his great love for the one below, God's love for the Jerusalem down below, asa acheret l'mala, he made another one on high. Sheneemar hen al kapayim hakotich chomotayich nig. Negdi tamid, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Where do we hear that? Yeah, we heard that just before in our Gemara previously, that God's going to keep us on the palm of the hand. The walls are continually before me. V'chein amar David, Yerushalayim habenuya ke'ir shechubra layachdav. And so said David, Jerusalem that is built together is a city that is joined together. And there's our verse, right? That's what we just read, that it's Chubra Yachdav. That is to say, Kalomar, Ki'ir Shebanav Yah, that the Lord built that city. But Tirgem, that we have a translation into Aramaic that we call Targum Yonatan, Yerushalayim de mit banya berkia kekarta de itchabarat kachada be'ara. That Jerusalem was built as a city in the heavens to be joined with the one that is on the earth. V'nishba sheshchinato. And he swore the following, lo yikanes ashchina, the shchina will not enter b'shel mala, the one on high, ad sheyibaneh shel mata, until the Jerusalem down below is built. So that answers the question. When I asked, what do you think the answer? So the Midrash purports that it's really about the build-up of Jerusalem, that God will go in the supernal one, the upper one, when God is down below and able to be in the down below. Kama chavivin Yisrael lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how beloved is Israel before God, uminayin, and how do we know this? Sheken Kativ, it's written, Bekir Becha Kadosh, into your midst there's a holy, Velo Avo Be'ir, there's holiness, and I will not come into the city. Hosea, that's our verse again. Except what? It's in reverse order here. Right? First we learned that it's going to be Chubra. Then we learned that God will go into the city on high when there's a city down below. And here we say, and that, we know God is really someone, God loves the Jewish people. Why? Because there's holiness there. And when there's holiness there, lo avo be'ir, I'm not going to come into the city. Va'ata ma'al li fo ne'um Hashem ki lukach amichinam. For whence do we know this? It's written, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not enter into the city. It says, now therefore, what have I here, said the Lord, that my people is taken away for naught? Rotse lamar, that is to say, Va'ata ma'ali fo ne'um Hashem. What have I here, said the Lord? What do I request here? Ma'ani mevakesh po b'Yerushalayim. What do I request here in Jerusalem? Achar shelukach ami mimena, after Jerusalem was banished from Jerusalem. V'chinam sha'avova, shall I come without my people here? Lo avo, I will not come. Yehi ratzon sheyibaneh b'mheira v'yamenu, may it be that Jerusalem is rebuilt hastily, soon, as speedily as it can be in our days, so that what? God can get back there. So this is a time when the Midrash is describing time of exile. And when we are exiled, God can't come to the city below. And God can't come to the city then on high. So what do you make of this idea that there are two Yerushalayims, one heavenly, one below? Does it give you a sense that, well, let's put it this way. A, what's it doing here? We just finished the Shelah for rain. We had a pasuk that was explained that in the days of Joel there was a famine and there was a problem. And now we have another instance. You could just say, well, what it's doing here is because I have Rabbi Nachman asking Rabbi Yitzchak something and Rabbi Yochanan is helping us decipher verses. And that could just be the answer.
Yeah, there were two kind of puzzling things that were very specific with the same people.
Yeah, so the same people make the parallel.
That seems like the obvious one.
That's the obvious one. And I'm asking, is there something else going on? What's the connection between the subject matter, if you will, that we're in?
The miracle of rain. Maybe the miracle that Jerusalem will become Jewish again.
Right, so maybe there's some parallelism going on with the hope, and the hope is that it's somehow in God's power to bring it back at the right season, that we will experience this, like we experienced this amazing growth in the days of Joel, even when there's a dry period. In other words, when there's an extended period when there's a drought from Jerusalem, that keep hoping, because what else do I say in my Amidah? The connection to me, for me, is that it's in our Amidah that we're not only asking for rain, but we're also saying, Yerushalayim ircha barachamim tashuv. Our daily prayers, three times a day, have within it the passage to Jerusalem, please return in your mercy. Please return in your mercy. So immediately, at least stories one and two, for me, are glued together by making meaning for a daily Amidah. Hold out hope. If it's not raining yet, continue to say it. Hold out hope. You're not in Jerusalem yet? Jerusalem's not completely rebuilt? God's presence isn't there? There isn't a heavenly and an earthly Jerusalem connected yet? Hold out hope. Even when you think Jerusalem is inhabited on the earthly basis, and you don't feel like there's such a heavenly nature to every precinct in Jerusalem yet, hold out hope. Hold out hope. I like it as a notion of prophecy, as an encouragement. Joel's encouragement to plant and sow, I think, is an encouragement also to hold out promise for Jerusalem, in that sense.
When did they start making the pious cemetery on the top of
Mount of Olives? Mount of Olives?
Yeah, I don't know that I can answer that question. I don't really know the history of the cemetery there.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely in the valley there of the dry bones, we could say that we knew that there were deaths in the valley that Ezekiel had his visions about down below. But
Ozay Tame is the one that, and many of the very religious people.
Right, today that's true. I'm not sure of the history and the beginnings
that's
of that.
Why? Because when you're up there, you look down on Jerusalem.
I don't know. I mean, the traditions of having burial caves and Hebron and that and the like, that's of course recorded in Torah and ancient, but you have to teach your lips to say, I just don't know.
So if there is another city, who inhabits that other city? If there's another Jerusalem. So, you know, God only needs a throne. God doesn't need a whole city. So,
but he has lots of angels.
So, I'm sure someone has tried to understand, you know, who lives or who inhabits the celestial Jerusalem.
That is such a good question, and there are layers to the palace. It's not just a throne. You know, palace mystical literature of this time imagined various chambers and rooms of the palace, rungs of heaven in order to get to the palace. angelic beings are definitely, you know, pre the angel figures with wings that come out in all kinds of iconography from the Middle Ages, early Byzantium. We have this whole understanding of a world of angels. Are they in the Yerushalayim Shalmala? Or are they on a larger expanse of Shemayim? I don't know, but that's the kind of... I think those are the kinds of images that these words wind up painting for people, especially who have the propensity towards wanting to imagine a divine realm. Yeah, Jay?
I like what you said. I generally do, but in this case too. But there's
thank you.
There's a very optimistic message here, because we could easily interpret drought as being a sign of disfavor, divine disfavor. But the message is, keep plugging away. And the fact that God is in it with us, because God has to accept a lesser result for the fact that there wasn't the growth because there was less rain. But likewise, God is in exile at the same time we are. Mm. So as bad as things seem...
Is he in exile as we are?
He's in exile too.
In the same diaspora that we are, or is he in a different diaspora?
He has his own place where he is, but he... You understand the concept.
No, because if it's we with us, we don't need to go back to Jerusalem.
No. Okay, anyway.
Well, no, but Jay, you're making an important reference to another Midrash that was, you know, quote-unquote part of the literacy of this whole question of what's this Jerusalem and what could we make of this Jerusalem. Jay's pointing out Midrash. I believe it's also Tanchuma. I believe that there's also parallel Mechilta, early Midrashim, that when we are in exile, God is in exile with us, especially the Shekhinah is in exile with us, God's indwelling presence. And it's a longing for exile to be ended in that way.
This Midrash right here, though, he's saying, there's no purpose to me there without my people. He doesn't necessarily say I can't go there, but he's certainly saying, what's the purpose without my people? So,
what's my purpose? And if that longing of God to return, along with the people's longing to return, is part and parcel, it really furthers my own sense of the empathic divine in my prayers and the kinds of longings that I can express within my Amida, if these two are parts of the Amida. Now, I'm proposing this question about whether or not these are connected to the Amida. Admittedly, having looked through the rest of the Gemara. So I'm not holding the Gemara accountable for now relating everything back to the daily Amida. That's not what I'm doing. But if I only had these two, I think there would be a wonderful, and with these two, there's a wonderful superstructure here that is being addressed, and that is the super cultural structure of me, the prayer, reading this Gemara for some inspiration. And not just when to stop saying the prayer for rain. But now it's thinking of me as a prayer of my daily Amida.
The starting point is exactly there. This all begins by specifically referencing the Amida and when this form was said, as opposed to outside of that.
Right.
One more question.
Yeah.
So is God not back in Jerusalem because the temple is not built? You're there, but the temple is not there.
So I would answer like this in good theological paradoxes. God's everywhere still. Oneness is God. God is oneness. God is all reality, right? But the Shekhinah is not in Jerusalem. God's indwelling presence can't be felt. I can't access the divine and that taste of something more of this reality as a Jew. I can't access that Shekhinah, that closeness of that neighborly, godly nearness of the Shekhinah when we don't have Jerusalem. there are different experiences of divinity that already are taking form within rabbinic literature and within even Mishneh and for sure in liturgy. And when I open myself up to the possibilities of experiencing those divine essences, I seek language to try to capture in a way, just like I'm saying about visual art, trying to capture an emotion or a moment. I seek language that allows me to give expression to that. The language we've sought for that nearness of a Jerusalem experience, that when Jerusalem is in our hands and we are at the temple and we are in that rapturous moment of sacrifice and coming together to sing and to pray and to be and to collect ourselves, that is Shekhinah. And that's not present when we're not in Jerusalem. So that's what's going on here mystically.
Well, but just like, especially for you, as art, religious language is necessarily ambiguous and multilingual. It isn't a contradiction. The two exist together, so they may seem as if they're fighting one another. As the rabbi said, I mean, for the notion that God is every place, and yet somehow there's some place he isn't, is very essence sort of a religious language, and especially when it veers into mystical language. But it's, you sort of have to embrace that, even though it's hard up here. It sounds contradictory, but we need that.
Is there another miracle in the Talmud that took place in within 11 days?
It's a good question. I love the question. Like now that we're going to have 11 to go back to and say, yeah,
because now,
now we know what 11's for.
Exactly, it's a point.
Yeah, I'll look. It's a good question. All right, so let's do a little bit more text inside, see where the next Rav Nachman to Rabbi Yitzchak question is going at least, and let's call it a night then. So, Va'amar le Rav Nachman to Rabbi Yitzchak, because we have these stories in these forms. Rav Nachman says to Rabbi Yitzchak, Ma'i dichtivu v'achat yivaru v'yichsalu musar chavavim etzu. What's the meaning of that which is written, they are altogether senseless and stupid, a rebuke in vain, if you will. A rebuke of vanities. Each one is wooden. Amar lei, Rabbi Yitzchak answered him, Hachem Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan is our key to deciphering these mysterious verses. Achat hi shemiva'eret rishaim begehenom. The verse teaches that it is but one transgression that causes the wicked to be burned in Gehenom. And with this, I'm going to introduce the topic of Gehenna, only as I'll introduce the word here tonight, and we will talk more about it the next time we get together. Mahi, which transgression is that? Avodah Zarah, idolatry. The verse refers to idolatry. It's derived as follows: Kativ Hacha Musar Chavalim Eitzu. Here it's written, a rebuke of vanities are in vain. Each one's wooden. Uchtiv hatam hevel hem masei tatuim. And elsewhere it's written in reference to idolatry, they are a vanity, a work of delusion. And thus we see that the word hevel, vanity, refers to idols. Ah, and that, if I may leave it for tonight, even though we're a few minutes early, I want to leave it here because I want to explore these a little the next time we get together. Where does the word hevel bring you?
Hevel avalim kohelet.
Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. I've now reinterpreted to be in vain for the reading of Kohelet. What have I said everything is or could be?
It's ephemeral.
Idolatry? Could be ephemeral, but it's idolatry. Over here, Hevel is idolatry. Idolatrous. It's all idolatrous. Your trust, your belief, your quote-unquote worship of all this. It's not that it's all in vain. It's that you could very easily, if you read Kohelet with this interpretation, you could very easily commit the sin of idolatry. Hevel, hevel. And that changes the read of Kohelet forever. Go back now. Look at the book of Kohelet, which we'll do together next time we get together. I'll bring you the Pesukim. Look at where hevel comes up. Look, and like I said, I want to explore it a little bit next time. We're going to explore what Gehenna means. We're going to explore what rereading Kohelet with this understanding of Hevel means, because it's a fascinating reread when we think that we're pursuing things in vain. It is very different to say that we may be making an idol of something, and that Kohelet's really trying to address this central sin that we could easily fall into and pay a big price for. And we don't want to do that. And I think, again, you want to bring it back to what we're talking about, what we're praying about, what we're recognizing. We never want to idolize the rain. We never want to make an idol of the forces of nature. We for sure want to steer clear of any idolatry when it comes to the worship of God. And we're for sure not making Jerusalem or the temple or any installation in the temple or any vessel of the temple, because this story follows a little bit about Jerusalem. We're not making any idolatry happen there. And we are making sure that Jerusalem is the center of where God's presence lies, the God of the universe, who is the all-powerful and mighty God. Welcome to class.
Oh,
you can take it if you'd like. Okay.